Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. A massive offensive to take Mosul, Iraq from ISIS started a few days ago. Most of the reporting has focused on the military operation itself, but there are up to 1.2 million people living in Mosul. So what will happen to them, and where is that reporting? Joining us to discuss coverage is BuzzFeed's Middle East correspondent, Borzu Daragahi. Hi, Borzu. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Craig Atkinson. Later in the show, we will talk to Craig about his new documentary, Do Not Resist. It explores the militarization of police forces in the United States. Since 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security has given police departments $34 billion in grants to purchase equipment. Craig Atkinson is an award-winning producer, cinematographer, and director. Do Not Resist won the Best Documentary Feature Award at the 15th Tribeca Film Fest in New York, and it opens today at the Roxy in San Francisco and the Rialto in Berkeley. And Craig joins me in studio. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So, Craig, I know you've been swamped with the film, but over the last couple of weeks, what's really caught your attention?
Well, I'd have to point people to the Intercept article that Ava Kaufman wrote, which highlighted the 50 civil rights organizations that approached the Justice Department with a report questioning the efficacy of facial recognition software, and that's something close to home because it's something that we covered in our film. It was interesting to note that during the 21st Century Task Force meeting that we filmed, which, if you remember, was the president's best team to look at police issues in this country, Charles Ramsey from Philadelphia Police Department was on the panel, and he questions, you know, he says, you know, we all have license plate readers. How long until facial recognition software is going to get added and you're driving down the faces and you're scanning faces of people? This was shocking to us because we had filmed the LAPD doing that a year prior. And so when you had, you know, the president's best team questioning when this might happen in the future, and we knew from our own filming and production that the LAPD had been doing this for a year prior, it just spoke to us about the real concern. So I was happy to see that The Intercept took a hold of this and showcased the groups that are questioning the Justice Department about it.
So kudos to Ava Kaufman.
Correct.
At The Intercept about this. And your film takes a look at technology and what's being used, and we will definitely talk about that later in the show. That's Craig Atkinson, director of the new documentary, Do Not Resist. And what about you, Borzu? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I thought was just an incredible piece of writing and reporting was a piece in the Washington Post, The White Flight of Derek Black by Eli Saslow. This was a piece about a child prodigy of the white supremacist movement in the U.S. The sort of royalty. His father was a founder of Stormfront or something like that, and his mom was the ex-wife of David Duke, and he was being groomed to be this sort of white supremacist superstar. He was really interested in medieval European history, and so he went to this place called the New College of Florida, which had this medieval European history program. And there, this sort of very long story describes the process of transformation that he underwent, how it was an Orthodox Jew who, once he discovered that, you know, who this guy was, sort of decided and rallied some kids to sort of embrace this guy, try to connect with him, try to help him grow out of, you know, this sort of world that he came from. And, you know, eventually the guy broke away and he renounced the movement and so on. And it was just a really incredible story. It kind of humbled me because, you know, you see someone who has politics that you find abhorrent and you kind of shun them. But here was a case where, you know, these kids, these college kids, decided that we're not going to shun this guy. We're going to sort of wrap our arms around him and talk to him and see if we can make a difference with him. And they did.
Wow. It's so interesting because so many of these views come from parents. I mean, right? I mean, sometimes they might diverge and they're influenced by other things, but so much of the time it happens because of their parents.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Kind of interesting what someone happens when they're on their own.
Wow. And so he's only 27. I'm just looking at the photo of Derek Black.
Yeah. He is now 27, but, you know, the sort of process, now he's in, like, grad school and studying, you know, he went, he, you know, since this whole thing has happened to him, he went to Morocco to learn Arabic. He sort of, you know, sort of turned his whole worldview around, you know. Maybe this guy was sort of exceptional. Maybe he was a little too smart to be a part of a thuggish, fascistic movement. But, you know, still, it was a really amazing story.
Wow. Well, this is definitely weekend reading. The White Flight of Derek Black by Eli Saslow at the Washington Post. And we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. Borzu, you have been reporting on this massive offensive to take Mosul, Iraq from ISIS, which started just a couple of days ago. Because so much attention has been on the presidential election here, before we dive in and talk about details, can you give us a little bit of context around this?
Mosul is Iraq's second largest city. In June of 2014, ISIS, which had previously been in northeastern Syria, swooped into northern Iraq and seized control of the city and much of northern Iraq in a lightning offensive. They were headed towards Baghdad, and finally, you know, with the help of Iranian militia leaders and U.S. Advisors and so on, they blocked ISIS from getting to Baghdad. And then ever since then, the last two and a quarter years, Iraqi forces have been retraining, rearming, reequipping in this sort of effort to town by town, city by city, fight against ISIS. And, you know, the battle for Mosul was, you know, the sort of big centerpiece of this conflict. I remember when the ISIS took over Mosul more than 2 years ago. I talked to U.S. officials, senior U.S. officials, who told me it's going to be 2 years before Iraqi troops are ready to take on ISIS in Mosul. And here we are, 2 years, more than 2 years. And so now they're ready and they're moving in.
The United States has sent thousands of special forces to Iraq. What is the role of these forces? How extensive is U.S. military involvement in Iraq?
It's rather small, actually. You know, there's thousands of U.S. military personnel on the ground in Iraq, maybe a few thousand, maybe up to 5,000. But as for the people who are, you know, commando, special forces embedded with Iraqi troops and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, and also tribal militias, the number is rather small. I would say maybe 1,000. Scattered around, you know, working on targeting airstrikes, perhaps operating specialized equipment and so on. And, you know, sort of rallying in many, you know, it was interesting. I was just in Anbar province in Iraq just a few weeks ago. Okay. And I was with these, you know, Sunni tribal fighters, as well as Iraqi federal police and some soldiers. And the way they were talking about just having the Americans there at a nearby base, just a few hundred of them, and it just gave them confidence, you know, like America is behind us. Of course we're going to beat ISIS. Hmm. So I think a lot of it is just psychological to have the greatest armed forces in the world behind you, backing you, sort of, you know, is a confidence booster to these guys who suffered a big defeat. Two and some years ago.
Is their presence felt on the street among ordinary Iraqis?
Not at all. I mean, this is not the occupation. The Americans are invisible in Iraq. You can barely see them. My colleague Mike Giglio, who's right now in northern Iraq, he mentions every now and then, as he's with the troops, as he's with the Kurdish Peshmerga who are moving in on Mosul, every now and then they'll run into a jeep load of American special forces guys, you know, quietly working with the Iraqi forces. But it's definitely not, as you may know, as listeners may not know, I was in Iraq from 2003 to 2007. I was there during the occupation when U.S. soldiers were manning checkpoints. It's nothing like that right now. There's, you know, hardly any presence of Americans in Iraq right now.
What about other forces? The Guardian's Martin Chuloff reports that there are British and Australian forces there, New Zealand special forces. How many countries?
French. Danish. Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. A few hundreds. You know, we're talking about hundreds serving as advisors, trainers, as I was sort of illustrating, morale boosters in terms of encouraging these guys to use the skills that they've developed over the last couple of years. and also just sort of giving them the feeling that they're not alone in this fight, that, you know, the world is with them in this fight against ISIS.
You mentioned Iran earlier. What role is Iran playing?
You know, the Iranians have helped train and create one very large and very important element and aspect of the force that's fighting against ISIS. You have these volunteer forces, although they're not volunteer anymore, they're paid salaries, called the Popular Mobilization Units. And these are basically militias, often rooted in some kind of tribal or clerical or religious political leader that are also taking part in this fight. And these guys are really controversial because many consider them, there are also Sunni militias of this type, but most of them are Shia, and many consider them rather sectarian, that, you know, they're not really fighting for Iraq, they're fighting for religious reasons. And so there's a lot of bit of controversy about the role of the popular mobilization units or militias in this war against ISIS.
And you were reported very closely on militias in Ramadi, right? Can you tell us about that experience?
Well, the story's not out yet.
Okay.
But, yeah, actually I was. But, you know, I would say that right now there's quite a few Sunni militia leaders, these sort of emerging warlords in Anbar province that are, you know, basically supplanting the central government. So, you know, what I would say, you know, just in, I haven't done the story yet, it's coming soon. What I would say is that the militia problem is not just a, you know, Shia problem. It's not just a sectarian issue. It's more of a the broader issue is the complete breakdown of the Iraqi state and the rise of these warlords.
And Borzu, so much of the attention is focused on the military operation itself, but there are up to 1.2 million people living in Mosul. What's going to happen to civilians? And what is happening to civilians?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge logistical challenge for the Iraqi government and various NGOs and the international community. What happens if these people sort of up and leave Mosul because of the nature of the fighting? I think there's a lot of questions still. For now, the Iraqi military is, and the Iraqi government is advising people, if they can, to just stay in their houses. Don't leave. Don't contribute to any refugee crisis. Knowing that that is a very big possibility. They have set up some tents. They have set up some kind of centers to receive any displaced people and so on. But it all kind of depends on how this conflict is shaped, how it takes form as Iraqi troops and Kurdish Peshmerga and potentially other militia forces descend on Mosul. How will the battle look? Will it be, you know, street-to-street fighting among people that will drive the ordinary people to leave their homes, pack everything they can in their car, and head out towards the countryside? Or will ISIS, as it has in the past, sort of quietly slip away and wait to do battle another day? So, no one knows the answer to these questions, so no one knows the extent of any humanitarian crisis should it come. But winter is coming. Temperatures are getting lower. Iraqi houses and buildings in general have really bad insulation. So, you know, there's going to be some issues. Most definitely.
Mm. Well, Borzu, we will follow your reporting. And as always, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. That is Borzu Daragahi. He is BuzzFeed's Middle East correspondent based in Istanbul. He is reporting on the massive offensive to take Mosul, Iraq from ISIS. And you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. And we are going to switch gears now and talk about the new documentary, Do Not Resist, which explores the militarization of police forces in the United States. Since 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security has given police departments across the country $34 billion in grants to purchase military equipment that was used overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan, for example. But we learned during the Senate hearing that 36% of that equipment was never used by the military, a whopping 36%. And Craig Atkinson is an award-winning producer, cinematographer, and director of this documentary. It's a must-see documentary. It's very disturbing, but very eye-opening. It opens today at the Roxy in San Francisco and the Rialto in Berkeley. And Craig joins me here in studio. Craig, you come at this from such an interesting perspective because your father was a police officer for 29 years right outside of Detroit. He was a SWAT team officer for 13 of those years. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about this in a minute, but the access you got to SWAT teams was just unreal. You actually felt like you were going on the, I don't know, what do they call it, mission?
The raids. The search warrants.
Yeah.
Yes.
So talk about just your personal experience because of your father.
Well, I mean, no, I had something to compare what we were seeing in today's terms of police militarization to what I remember my father's era to be. And this was like the war on drugs era of policing. He became a SWAT officer in 1989. They were facing violent criminals in their area and they needed, you know, more protective equipment. In that era, however, it was, you know, reserved for the most violent criminals, the barricaded gunmen, the hostage situation. To give some context, he only did 29 search warrants in the 13 years that he was on SWAT. And you contrast that teams we were going out with while making the film, same size department, and they're doing 3 to 4 raids a year, or I'm sorry, 3 to 4 raids a day, over 200 a year. So there's been a significant mission creep in terms of how SWAT is actually deployed. And my original curiosity was witnessing the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing. It was the first time I had seen the armored vehicles and the weapons. But also the mentality of the police department seemed to have shifted from a protect and serve model to more of an occupying force. And in conjunction with the project, we went up and interviewed people in Boston, and they said, oh, yes, we had officers coming in our homes despite our protests that we didn't want them to search our homes. One couple said we were pulled out, you know, handcuffed face down on our front lawn for 4 hours, mm-hmm. never told why we were being detained, and then no charges were subsequently filed. So to me, it spoke to that we have shifted into a different era, and the genesis of the project was, you know, curiosity to know what had changed.
The numbers are incredible. In the 1980s, there were about 3,000 SWAT deployments a year, 3,000 a year. Today, there are between 50,000 and 80,000 per year.
That's correct. And, you know, I constantly throughout the course of making this project said, why this increase? And then the raid that we went on, to me, demonstrates why the increase. And during this raid on a home that was supposed to be a drug kingpin, mm-hmm. and this individual was supposed to be there by himself, well, no, he was a 22-year-old college student, African-American college student. His family was there. A 4-month-old baby was there. He had his own landscape business. He said he had $800 to buy a weed whacker that afternoon. That money was seized from him. And when you look at the mechanism by where these police officers are able to go out and seize this property through civil asset forfeiture, meaning that your property is guilty until you prove it innocent. Well, how does one do that? It's very, very difficult, especially when it costs maybe $3,000 to get it back in a court of law, but you're only trying to get back $876. And when we returned to the police department after the raid, the commanding officer, number one thing he said, did we seize anything? And I could just tell that this was the reason why we were going out into these neighborhoods. It was almost like a wealth extraction practice.
That was the scene in which one of the officers said, "Where the F is the weed?" Right?
Right, yes.
I mean, it was... Can you just sort of set this up for us? Because it's, first of all, how did you get access? Because you do feel you did go on the raid with these SWAT team members. How did you get such close access?
Well, I think, you know, it's not unprecedented for film crews to go out with police departments. The TV show Cops has been operating since 1989, and Cops was actually filming with the St. Louis County SWAT team while we were there. They just weren't on that particular raid. And I think what people are responding to is our approach in filmmaking. And whereas cops might glorify or often glorify the officers and condemn the accused with just pixelated faces, our approach was, let's not do either. Let's put the camera right in the situation and let's observe neutrally and see if we can draw our own conclusions. And, you know, that's why we went back the next day and spoke to the family, because oftentimes in these cop shows, it's just, you know, pixelated faces of people who then get locked up and you never hear what that experience might have been like. So we went the next day and spoke with the family, and they said, yeah, we thought we were involved. You know, we thought a terrorist attack was happening. And it's no mystery as to why, when we were talking to the officers during training exercises, they said that they were preparing for ISIS and they were preparing for the next 9/11. The unfortunate reality is that there's 63 million police-citizen interactions every year. And if you're taking that mentality into those police, you know, those civilian interactions, it's no wonder how we see this.
I want to play a clip because it's so rare that the families who have to endure this trauma are given a voice in our media or our society. And so in this clip, you are going to hear from one of the SWAT team members, followed by the mother of a young black man who was arrested for having a small amount of marijuana in the bottom of a bag. This is the clip from Do Not Resist.
Marijuana, personal use, would appear to be. And that's about it. It happens. Drug warrants are, you know, 50-50. Just want to research it.
I heard a big bam. I thought somebody was going to get robbed or something. I didn't know what to expect. First thing I asked, y'all looking for a terrorist? Y'all think a terrorist in here? Because that's the kind of feeling that I had. They're looking for something really strong, really important. I mean, government stuff. They tore down my house. My son went to jail for a gram and a half that they shook at the bottom of a book bag.
Wrong church, wrong people, wrong day.
He was out the same night they took him. Thank God for that.
And that's a clip from the film Do Not Resist. Sorry, the first part of that got cut off, but that was a SWAT team member. After this SWAT team raided this home, they broke a window. And the first thing I thought was, why did they break this window? No one can get out of this window. What was the point of that?
So that was what they call a distractionary technique. So you make a distraction in one part of the home, so the occupants go to that area, and then you would enter through another part of the home so that it would be less dangerous for the officers, apparently. But unfortunately, the guy who was supposed to be there by himself, his father was sleeping in the bedroom, and when they started smashing out the windows, glass was falling on him. So you're waking up and it's broad daylight. You think that you might be under attack, and there's been so many situations where police have raided the wrong homes with these style of techniques. And you know, most people in this country have guns in their homes. They reach for a weapon and they end up getting themselves killed, and there's no recourse because you're actually pointing a gun at an officer. The St. Louis County SWAT team that we show in the film, who literally is looking up on Google Earth before they raid the home, and one officer jokes on how he's dyslexic and had the address reversed. Well, that same SWAT team raided the wrong home 6 months later. After seeing that scene or filming that scene with them and then hearing that in the news, I mean, it was no wonder how this happens, but it's obviously goes without saying how dangerous that is for citizens.
Right, and so you see clips of the family members just sitting outside looking distraught. The young man was arrested. He was brought back home that night. Mm-hmm. And then the SWAT team member said, "We located a small amount of marijuana. It happens." I mean, off camera, did you ever ask these guys, do you feel bad about this? I mean, this is traumatizing for people.
Right. You know, it is very traumatizing. And when they say they do 200 raids a year, we all know that it's not 200 raids a year all over the county. It's 200 raids a year in a small geographic footprint, the low income area, oftentimes the person of color area. And so I just think about, we're pulling kids out of these homes. What is the long term effect? The psychological trauma that you're putting these children through. I don't think it's any different than our drone program overseas when you find out that only 10% are intended targets. 90% are either unknown or civilians. And we wake up years after that type of war and wonder why everyone's so upset with us. I don't think it's any different than the frequency in which you're sending troops into homes. I just think the long-term effect is so damaging. The officers are oftentimes, checking into a job, punching the clock, and, looking at the big picture of why we're actually doing this on a day-to-day basis, often does not, come up in the mind. It's usually like, I need to do this task before I can go home to my wife and kids. And so, we didn't really get into too many conversations with officers because their focus seemingly was always about getting through this next objective to return home.
What about media coverage of these raids, considering the fact that SWAT deployments are happening so often across this country? Are the media reporting on this?
Well, I mean, you know, there have been some reports. The ACLU came out with a brilliant report called The War Comes Home, and they were looking at, you know, factors and, you know, our anecdotal evidence by going out with 18 different police departments during the course of making this film actually matched up their findings. 40% of the SWAT team members were ex-military. You know, 90% of the SWAT deployments were search warrants, and most of those were for low-level drug search warrants. So those figures are coming out. The problem is there isn't any standard reporting for SWAT teams across the country. The only place that required it was Maryland. And the only reason why that happened is because the mayor of Berwyn Heights, Maryland, had his home raided by mistake. He had his house raided. The mayor had his house raided by mistake. So, of course, now that it's happened to a person of, you know, in position and in power, of course, that gets a change. And in 2010, they started to require police departments, SWAT teams in Maryland, to just report figures on how they were deployed. And wouldn't you know it, matched up the exact same findings that the ACLU had. The unfortunate reality is that that came up for renewal in 2014, and they just decided not to renew it. So here we are back again with zero reporting statistics across the country for SWAT deployments.
Craig Atkinson is director of the new documentary Do Not Resist, which explores the militarization of police forces across the country. The film opens today at the Roxy in San Francisco, and Craig will be doing a Q&A tonight at 7 o'clock. It also opens at the Rialto in Berkeley, and you can find more information and check out the trailer at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with host Lauren Schiller. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will be joined by climate scientist Michael Mann to talk about his book, The Madhouse Effect, how climate change denial is threatening our planet, destroying our politics, and driving us crazy. Considering the fact that climate change did not come up during any of the presidential debates, we decided that we needed to talk about it. So that's Monday. Tuesday, we'll be joined by Ralph Nader for the hour. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And don't forget, on Monday, it's the last day to register to vote in California. And if you'd like to be around friends and community, we are doing a live broadcast on election night at the Roxy Theater from 7 to 9. It's free. Doors open at 6. So if you'd like to be around some your community, we hope you can come out for that. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we're joined by Craig Atkinson, director of the new documentary, Do Not Resist. It explores the militarization of police forces across the United States. Craig comes at this from personal experience. His father was a police officer for 29 years outside of Detroit and a SWAT officer for 13 of those years. Do Not Resist opens today at the Roxy. Craig will be doing a Q&A at tonight's 7 o'clock screening. It also opens at the Rialto in Berkeley, and he'll be there tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. And if you have any questions for Craig about what he found, he got incredible access to SWAT teams and to these training centers in Orlando, Florida. So what questions do you have about the media coverage of these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. To spend a little bit more time on these SWATs, these raids, again, there are about 50 to 80,000 per year. And the SWAT team members on camera said half of them are for drug warrants. A typical raid, they search a house, they break the windows, they charge in, scare the hell out of everyone in the house, and maybe find a small amount of marijuana. Is there any recourse for these people? And is it fair to assume that they're mostly low-income people of color?
Mm-hmm. There is very little recourse. The gentleman that had his money seized, through civil asset forfeiture, it's the burden of proof is on him. So it's very difficult to prove that your money wasn't used in this way. And I just want to point out that the officer actually said that search warrants are 50-50, meaning that they only find stuff 50% of the time. And this is a huge departure from, the original idea of, the search warrant was so that you could, have better armament to go into a home against someone who might be barricaded or, arm themselves. The thing is, in my father's era of SWAT, when he actually only did 29 search warrants in 13 years, they were required to basically make their case before entering the home. The entry of the home was only to arrest the individual, whereas it evolved to let's go and fly in there 100 miles an hour and try to recover the contraband before it's disposed of, flushed down the toilet. And so you're not doing proper investigative work prior to going into the home, and these search warrants have become like a rubber stamp. The search warrant that we went on was solely based off of testimony of an informant. And we know that informants are often looking to get themselves out of trouble. So what is the incentive to not point down the street and say that person did it? I mean, that was basically the evidence that they went off of. And sure enough, we didn't find anything. We went on a half a dozen raids while making the film, never found anything.
A half a dozen, you found nothing.
The police department, a bowl of weed one time. And they destroyed this home that we were in. They found a bowl of weed. On the wall, there was a certificate from the individuals that had just went through drug counseling program. So this is a drug user. This couple was in their 60s.
Mm.
You had a group of 12 officers in their home, tearing up their home. They were relentless. They went on for 2 hours of the search. They found a bowl of weed, and no charges were filed. And what was the subsequent recourse for these individuals? Well, none. Not only was there no legal recourse, but there's no financing to fight back. And so, this is something that has just gone on and on from, as you said, 3,000 in the 80s search warrants to now somewhere between 50,000 and 80,000 a year.
So what happens to the money that was seized?
Mm-hmm.
And how often does that happen?
That's a great question. The idea of asset forfeiture is actually a sound one on paper. You take a criminal's assets who's destroying your community, you put it into a general fund for the city, and you can build roads and schools and this type of activity. That's the original idea of asset forfeiture. However, the feds came in a number of years ago and created what's called the Equitable Sharing Program. So they approached police departments and said, listen, if you include one federal agent on your police department when you do a raid, then your department gets to keep 80% of the money directly, and we'll keep 20% as a kickback system.
The department keeps 80%.
For its own discretionary budget, yes. And the feds would take 20%. So here you have 2014 was the first year that American citizens had more property seized through asset forfeiture than they had taken from them through burglary.
What is it?
$5.1 billion taken through asset forfeiture in 2014. $3.5 billion taken from American citizens through burglary.
So these departments are getting 80% of $5.1 billion. How is that money spent, and is there transparency?
It's the equipment, personnel, anything they want. Once it goes back into the cities or the department's fund.
Is that separate from the grants they get from the Department of Homeland Security?
Yes.
Wow. So they're getting grants from $34 billion in grants from the Department of Homeland Security since 9/11 to buy equipment. But then they're also getting money
Then given the financial incentive to go use that equipment.
Right. And these guys, I mean, it looks like they just came back from Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, they've got so much equipment on them. They're in these MRAPs, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, mm-hmm. these massive military vehicles going down streets, passing children's parks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just so surreal to see this.
Yeah, here you are. What we really, looking back at what we filmed, it was really the transition between the war on drugs and the war on terror as it relates to domestic police work, because the tools of war always return home. And what we're seeing with the military hardware is the mentality of the officers, because like I said, 40% of these officers that we were going out with were ex-military themselves.
So let's talk a little bit about why this is happening and the tone that is set for police and military across the country. Can you please tell us about this man in your film, Dave Grossman? He is the country's number one military and police trainer.
Well, Yes, you know, we were interested once we started to go on these raids and see what we observed as almost a mentality breakdown amongst officers. We were curious to know how they were being trained, and we were constantly being told that Dave Grossman is this great trainer, and his philosophy was pervasive in almost all areas of police work. So we showed up with an open mind, not knowing what we were going to find. But during the course of the 6 hours, we were just absolutely shocked by his rhetoric. I mean, this is someone who spent 25 years of his career helping the military improve the kill ratio. So in World War II, the kill ratio was only 15% to 30%, because it's very hard for humans to kill other humans. There's a natural defense mechanism in the species. You know, you'll see in all species, really, you'll see deer lock horns with each other, but they'll gore someone from a different species. So there's a self-preservation mechanism that keeps humans from killing other humans. Well, by Vietnam, they improved the kill ratio to 90%. How did this happen? They hired people like Dave Grossman to help improve the kill ratio by doing what? By desensitization training and by teaching to kill through pop-up targets. So it became, quote, a conditioned response. And so now that was developed for 25 years. Now Dave Grossman has been teaching the exact same philosophy for 18 years in police work. And it's very interesting to point out that when you have this shoot first and question, ask questions later mentality, that's how, in my opinion, it leads to reaching for your wallet and getting shot 6 times. Mm. And it's interesting to point out that the officer that killed Philando Castile last July, this is the individual who we saw his life slip away via Facebook with a 4-year-old daughter in the back seat, that officer had attended one of Dave Grossman's trainings only months prior.
Wow. We're going to play a clip from Dave Grossman. Can you tell us about this seminar that he's leading?
Sure. This is a SWAT training seminar in Ohio for surrounding area SWAT teams, and this is typical of his speech that he gives over 250 times a year.
All right. So this is Dave Grossman, the country's number one military and police trainer.
The old saying, it's got to get worse before it gets better. Oh, it's going to get worse, folks. We are at war. And you are the frontline troops in this war. And folks, I want you to understand something. When they come to murder the children, the individuals who tried to disarm our cops will be hunted down. And across the nation, they will be attacked. They will be spit on. They will be driven deep into their slimy little holes so they'll never come out again. In the very near future, the idiots trying to disarm our cops. Folks, there ain't nobody in Mexico right now complaining about militarization of police. You understand? There ain't nobody in Russia complaining about militarization of police. In the very near future, you will be vindicated. The bad news, the wolf is at the door. Very bad times are coming. Good news, you have job security. Yeah. Because the world desperately needs what you have to give.
That is Dave Grossman, the country's number one military and police trainer. And we see a few clips from Dave Grossman in the new documentary, Do Not Resist, which explores the militarization of police forces across the country. It opens today at the Roxy in San Francisco. Craig Atkinson, the director of the film, will be doing a Q&A at 7 o'clock. It opens at the Rialto, also in Berkeley, and Craig will be there tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. You know, I have to say, just Dave Grossman's eyes, I mean, they were menacing when he was saying these things.
Yeah, you know, people have remarked on his actual physical appearance and his just his old, you know, his rhetoric and the way that he speaks. You know, I think when you're doing something for 18 years and you're never questioned and you're never checked. I mean, I saw young officers going up and getting his autograph after this, it's just disappointing to see that, because I think that a lot of these officers show up to, you know, to want to protect and serve, and I think that if they were given a different background mentality while going into early in their career, I think it could set up a completely different trajectory. But, you know, here we are seeing Dave Grossman being able to have a salon with these officers. He's required reading at the FBI Academy. He's required reading in many of the police academies throughout the country. So this is an absolutely pervasive mentality that has come through police departments. I must say, though, the sheriff of Santa Clara, California, Lori Smith, heard that the officer that killed Philando Castile had attended one of Dave Grossman's seminars, and she canceled his training. Hmm. And she looked at the program. She said, you know, this is probably going to make my deputies more prone to use deadly force. So this is someone that I'd like to congratulate openly and say we need others to stand up and to look at that level of training and just to, you know, and analyze, is this actually what we need our officers to be learning at this day and age? If there was ever a time and place for it, I don't think that this is what the community is asking of their law enforcement officials in these times.
I was going to ask, are there any other examples that you know about?
Of police trainers.
Santa Clara.
Not yet.
Saying
Not yet. I will say that we had a really interesting screening in New York at the John Jay Criminal Justice College, which is the feeder school for the NYPD, and there was over 300 in attendance. And many of them were active duty NYPD officers, and some got up and said, you know, thank you so much for making this film. It reflects reality. You know, you don't do a hit job on the cops, but you're there just to observe, and it actually shows some areas that we need to reform. And there was one SWAT commander that got up, who was a retired SWAT commander for the NYPD, and he immediately tried to put some distance between what the NYPD does and what Dave Grossman teaches, and said that, you know, he's not involved in our training modules, or, you know, this is not something we look to anymore. And I said, that's great for the NYPD, but if you look at his schedule, he's still booked, you know, 200 times this year. And so there are still so many departments that are getting that training on a regular basis.
Today, they're still getting this training.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I was when you were making this film, there's this conversation that's happening about Black Lives Matter, the killing of black and brown people in this country. And some of the conversation seems, I mean, when you compare it to what's really happening in these trainings, and then you're talking about racial bias, mm-hmm. I mean, how do you truly tackle this issue, given what you saw firsthand?
You know, I'm constantly questioning, like, how we actually move beyond in this way. And when you look at, you know, the long ingrained training and the history of what some of these, you know, older generation officers are bringing to their profession from the beginning, which is a tremendous amount of implicit bias, I'm not so sure that you're going to train that out of people. I think there are some modules that I've looked to that actually on paper show that you can improve the implicit bias training. But I think that that's going to take a very long time. And so my approach has always been, how do we reduce the number of times that police actually have interactions with citizens? You know, when we look at what happened in Ferguson, I mean, there was a complete policing for profit model where you're treating citizens like ATMs. There was a town right next to Ferguson called Jennings. They lost $1 million in sales tax revenue one year because they lost a shopping center. The very next year, they got $1 million more money from ticketing their citizens. And so because these communities are failing, they're using, you know, they're asking the police department to be like the tax collectors for a city. And we talked to plenty of officers. They said, you know, we didn't sign up for that. We'd much rather do, you know, good policing work. So my thinking is that you're not going to fix policing unless you take this profit motive away. And if you do, then, you know, in Jennings, there's $1 million more ticket that were issued. How many of those traffic stops turned violent? How many of those traffic stops turned into someone getting a ticket who couldn't pay it, who then got a bench warrant, who then had to go to prison, who had to survive in prison and become violent, because you have to do that to survive in prison, only to be let out 6 months later, a violent person who got pulled over for a taillight. So I think that this is a huge mechanism that we need to look at, because if we can reduce the number of times that police actually have to interact with their citizens, if they're not ticketing for profit to run their department, then you're going to see a decrease in killing. So for me, I don't think that you're going to, you know, train the bias out of all these people. I just want to reduce the number of times that those people with bias actually have interactions with citizens.
Craig Atkinson is director of the new documentary Do Not Resist. It opens at the Roxy in San Francisco and the Rialto in Berkeley tonight. He'll be at the Roxy in San Francisco at 7 o'clock and at the Rialto in Berkeley tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. So, speaking of profit, since 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security has given police departments $34 billion in grants to purchase equipment. The Department of Defense has contributed an additional $5 billion in free military equipment. And MRAPs, these mine-resistant ambush-protected trucks, cost taxpayers $1.2 million each to manufacture. And in the film, we learn that MRAP armored vehicles are actually free under these programs. How does that work?
That's correct. So the 1033 program, which is the program that transfers military equipment to local law enforcement and is responsible for about $5 billion worth of this equipment that's transferred, these vehicles have already been purchased by the American taxpayer at $1.2 million. and they just give them to police departments without any training. And we were down in Texas where they used to train officers for a minimum of 80 hours before they ever let military personnel, 80 hours before they even let anyone drive one of these vehicles. And here they are giving the keys and letting them drive off the lot to police departments. There was a situation in California where an officer had picked up an MRAP from an Army base. They never told him that the max speed should be about 45 miles an hour because they're 45,000 pounds, and the friction alone can blow out the tires. Well, he was going 75 miles an hour down the freeway, and that's exactly what happened. He blew out his tires, hit a vehicle coming in oncoming traffic, had a head-on collision. Luckily, no one died. But again, it just shows that the fact that we're given this equipment without any guidelines of how it's used, and that's what we saw in Ferguson. All that DHS money given to buy armored vehicles and protective equipment, instead of it being staged off to the side and helping facilitate the protest, and then bring that equipment out if necessary. They just approached the protest community with that equipment, which is completely inappropriate from a tactical standpoint in and of itself, because it gives people something to rally against. So it actually escalates the situation.
And again, these MRAPs, these are these massive, they look like tanks, basically. They're huge vehicles. The very disturbing part of the film is focused on the MRAPs that are returned from Iraq and Afghanistan back to the United States. And one of the guys who spoke in the film said that he hopes all of the body parts have been taken out of the MRAPs before they arrive in the U.S., but that doesn't always happen.
Sure. That comment just puts it so close to home that these are vehicles designed for war. I mean, they have a V-hull, so they're supposed to resist roadside bombs, but obviously that doesn't work all the time, And so, this is the type of thing that is now returning home and being given to police departments. One scene that we never got in the film, which I was desperately trying to get for viewers because I think it would have really shown the full circle of where we find ourselves, is the fact that Unicor, which is the prison division that sells prison labor to the Department of Defense for about 10 cents an hour, it's prison labor. These MRAPs return back from war. Well, there's a division of Unicor, so again, prison labor, that rehab the vehicles before they give them to police departments.
Oh, wow.
So you have prisoners spraying down the body parts before they rehab the vehicle to give to police departments to go make more prisoners, and the cycle continues. We never got the scene. It's very difficult to film in federal prisons, but I mean, that was the visual I was hoping to convey because it is so full circle.
You have a clip from a Senate meeting on police use of military back in July. Republican Senators Tom Coburn and Rand Paul and Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill were questioning Alan Estevez with the he's the principal deputy under Secretary of Defense for Acquisition and Technology. And the senators seemed completely outraged by this. And these men from the DOD and FEMA basically said there's just no accountability. None?
I know. That scene in the film, when I was filming the scene, I actually got momentarily inspired because I was like, wow, this is our government at work. We have our elected officials and they're just hammering the military-industrial complex. But as the months went on and we tracked what actually came of that meeting, it was incredibly disappointing to find out that nothing came of that meeting. So here you have our elected officials trying to bring the DOD, DHS, and the Justice Department to task on how is this equipment being used? Do you have any oversight whatsoever? And they just blatantly say no. And then there's no course of action. It begs the question, who is running things here?
Wow. Who is running things here? Who's making these decisions?
Sure. Yeah. It seems as though the transfer equipment has been set up, with some people say the best intentions, because police get violent equipment in addition to, they get office furnitures and stuff that supplement their department. But, you can't put, office chairs in the same pool as MRAPs and, have no oversight whatsoever. I mean, this is how, abuse, tends to continue. And the other point is that, when we look at Ferguson and we look, well, why are these communities failing? That they need to go and tax their citizens and ticketing money. Well, when I go down to Texas, I see miles and miles of MRAPs that cost the American people $1.2 million apiece. It's no wonder why our communities are failing, because we spent the last decade and a half fighting wars we never should have. Now we're paying for it doubly because those tools are coming back, the mentality is coming back, and now we're facing the exact same thing domestically.
And this really affects poor people the most, people of color the most. You spoke with, or people shared stories with you in the film about algorithms predicting how they end up targeting people before they're even born. We did a show about this last week, just about all of this, these biased algorithms. Can you talk a little bit about that, and how do you begin to tackle that issue? Because it seems like that's exploding.
Yes. I mean, that is the trend in law enforcement, is the use of technology, and they say as a force multiplier. And we talked to plenty of departments around the country who don't have the money to hire personnel. People cost, you know, money for their salaries, their time off, their health care. Instead of hiring 10 officers, you only have to hire 2 and get all this technology and use it as a force multiplier. The problem is that we kept seeing private companies selling this equipment to law enforcement without any policy directives, without any oversight or, dictation of actually how this is going to be used. We saw one company that took the exact same IBM platform that the NSA uses to do mass data collection, and he was licensing it to police departments for $1,000 a year subscription, the exact same platform. And I said, well, how is this going to be used? And we show the University of West Virginia using it to scan the communications of their student body, and they show one individual who had a gram of weed, and she's like, good night, everyone, and smoking a bowl of weed. They went and knocked on her door. I mean, this is a technology that was only sold to the American people to be used on terrorism, and now here we see it being used for a gram and a half of weed. It's just, there's just been a tremendous escalation with that as well.
So this escalation has happened under the Obama administration. I understand that he did talk a little bit about these programs, but did he change anything?
No. In fact, one of the most surveilled departments in the country is Camden, New Jersey, and that's where he went and spoke about the findings of the 21st Century Task Force meeting and basically held Camden, New Jersey up as the model city, and it was completely surveilled. City. The thing is when we talk about predictive policing and running algorithms over data sets in order to predict their future likelihood of someone is going to commit a crime, we have to look at what data they're actually using. Mm-hmm. And what data they're using is CompStat data. CompStat data, if you're familiar, is basically crime statistical data that's been recorded throughout the country. However, they started using it as a performance matrix for chiefs. So if you don't make crime go down, you might not get the federal money in the next year. So they started like a fancy accounting techniques looking at aggravated assaults like simple assaults, and crime started to go down. So we don't even know if the data that we're using is accurate to run these algorithms over. And in fact, it looks like it's not.
Craig Atkinson is director of the new documentary Do Not Resist. He will be doing a Q&A tonight at the Roxy in San Francisco at 7 o'clock, tomorrow at the Rialto Elmwood in Berkeley at 7 o'clock. You can find the trailer for the film and learn more about it at yourcallradio.org. Craig, thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for being interested in the film.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Penn State climate scientist Michael Mann about his new book, The Madhouse Effect, how climate change denial is threatening our planet, destroying our politics, and driving us crazy. He says in the debate over climate change, pseudoscience or anti-science is too often allowed to masquerade as science. So why aren't the media doing more to report the truth? Join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.